Machiavelli said, the reason there will be no change is because the people who stand to lose from change have all the power. And the people who stand to gain from change have none of the power.
It becomes a way of colonizing the economies of the poor countries, a system of economic slavery.
Aid creates dependence. More aid and more aid and more aid.
Most of the money for aid doesn't actually get to the poor.
Aid has delayed the development of business in Africa. It has kept Africa behind.
It's time to change.
If the African nations today agreed together and say, no more aid. I tell you, they can grow slowly, but they can grow.
Economic transformation in the long term comes from locally owned businesses.
We need to transform our good intentions into things that actually work, allowing these individual human beings to create value and prosperity for themselves.
Entrepreneurship should become something that is the language and the life of our day-to-day people.
Business is the normative way that people rise out of poverty.
I've seen that. I've seen that through my business.
Small and medium-sized enterprises are a critical part in the development process. Job creation, employers who provide income for families who can take whole communities out of poverty.
And it grows and grows, and we begin to drive the bottom of the pyramid the other way around. We flip it around because it is possible.
People have lots of energy, lots of capacity.
These people are the engine of growth. They are changing slums into cities.
They're going to create success, they're going to create wealth that no state could ever create.
Instead of training job seekers, we train job makers.
Having a heart for the poor isn't hard. Can we have a mind for the poor? Can you really relate to the poor on a one-to-one basis? As equals, as partners, as colleagues.
Good intentions don't end poverty. Enterprise and freedom end poverty.
Economies can grow. And it's high time we stop telling our people they can't do it. Yes, we shall do it in the name of God.
You're listening to the Exploration Films Podcast.
Welcome to the Exploration Films Podcast. I'm your producer and host, Steve Ryder. Today's film we're featuring is Poverty Cure, a six-part series that challenges the traditional poverty charity industry, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, with innovative yet basic solutions to the complex issue of how to help struggling nations and economies. I had a chance to sit down with the host and executive producer of this amazing series, Michael Matheson Miller. Michael Matheson Miller, thanks for being on the Exploration Films Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be with you. It's taken a while for the schedule, so I'm happy we're doing it.
Well, we've had a great conversation before we started recording, and I'm super excited to feature this one because the idea of the problems of institutional poverty charity, if you will, I was alerted to those problems years ago, and a friend of mine told me about this series, and I watched it then, and then I rewatched it recently. It's so well done. Where'd the idea for this series come from?
Well, thank you. So I'm a senior research fellow at the Acton Institute, and we had years ago decided we wanted to do a project on global poverty. So started thinking about what would it look like, and we thought we would do a six-part, you know, or whatever, several-part video series, and then a full-length documentary. I had studied international development in Japan years before, and also philosophy, international business, and so I was interested in these things. These questions. My parents actually, after they retired, my mother was a physician, and so she was a mission doctor, and she and my father went to Ghana and worked there, and so I visited Ghana and was studying international development, all these things. And so all these things kind of came together, and we said, let's work on a project. And we wanted to do a couple of things. We wanted to look at the question of global humanitarianism from a critical eye, but also from a personalist foundation. And so I'll get to that in a second, but just more. The other thing is, I remember when I was in graduate school studying international development, international cooperation things, almost everything was what you could just call kind of like establishment humanitarian ethos. And if you wanted to find something that was a bit critical, if I was skeptical, I'm like, are we sure foreign aid is the best thing? And, you know, there was one guy, Peter Bauer, who I found one of his books at a used bookstore in London. And I thought, okay, this is great. And
of all places to find that.
Yeah. And he was a professor. He was Hungarian, but a professor in England, professor, I think at London School of Economics, I think. He had been critiquing aid early on and said that
really?
Aid created the third world. Yeah, we can talk about some of his work. Peter Bauer is really influential in this. And so but one of the things he said was that aid created the third world. He said, you know, this idea that why, and think about this actually, and because it goes back to the personal element. Why is it that we think about Madagascar, Nicaragua, Sierra Leone, East Timor, and India as the same? They're very different with very different people and very different cultures. But why? Well, because aid created this concept of the third world. And it's just like one kind of homogenous group of poor people who need our help. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's one of the, I think, problems with this whole dominant model. So Bauer was an early critique of this, a critic of it. So one of the things we wanted to do with Poverty Cure and the Poverty Cure DVD series, and then later Poverty Inc., the documentary film, was create a resource so people like me when I was younger could be able to go and say, okay, well, I want to learn about microfinance. Well, how do I think about this? Let me hear different views. Like, is it good? Is it bad? Well, okay, microfinance is the greatest thing ever. Microfinance is terrible. Microfinance is a mix. And we wanted to be able to, like, in a sense, work through, you know, these questions, these complex questions. And then at the same time, there was big, you know, the One campaign, and Jeffrey Sachs had written his very famous book called The End of Poverty. Mm-hmm. And so part of what we want to do is, in a sense, respond to that with different voices and not just kind of establishment voices.
Yeah.
And so we did, I think, about close to 200 interviews all over the world. And so we made this 6-part DVD series that's specifically for Christian audiences. Mm-hmm. And then we made a 90-minute full-length documentary film for general audiences. And a lot of the themes, there's some overlap, actually. There's some of the parts are in both video products, but and then some are different. But one of the things we thought was, okay, thousands of Christians throughout the world go help the developing world. But a lot of times without knowing it, we appropriate the kind of the dominant secular model. So let's address this specifically for Christians, and then we'll address another one broadly for Christians and for everybody. So for example, when we talk about private property, you know, if you're not a Christian or a Jew, you don't care what it says in Exodus or Genesis about private property, right? Or Acts. But you do if you're a Christian. It shapes the way. So we have those sections in Poverty Cure DVD series where we actually don't. Okay, what does Exodus 22 say? What is Genesis? What Acts? How do we think about private property? What's the tradition say? When we talk about private property and, you know, the general audience one, we don't bring in those biblical references. So that's kind of some over difference as well. But that was our idea, is to really like think about global humanitarianism and helping the poor from a different perspective, philosophically and theologically. Mm-hmm. And then also get stories and voices of people from throughout the developing world who were some of the strongest critics of dominant humanitarianism are from Africa, but they're not listened to because people don't have their voice. So it seems like basically it's like upper middle class Americans are fighting over who's holier and who's more concerned for the poor. And we don't actually listen to the voices of people from the developing world. So we wanted to bring that in too. That was a whole other part of what we're doing.
When I was growing up, we didn't have secondhand clothing from Europe and the US and Canada in Kenya. My mother took me to a store and she bought me a beautiful t-shirt that said made in Kenya, Kenya cotton. Today, I would struggle to find a t-shirt like that for my daughter. Why? Because the influx of secondhand clothing that makes its way here from Europe and the US and Canada has negatively impacted on our textile industry in Kenya. Massive layoffs in the 80s and the 90s. Factories that shut down. What happened to our cotton farms? When I was growing up in this country,
We could have bought cotton in varieties and types that are incomparable. But that's all gone because of the impact, the negative impact of the apparel imports at a second-hand level.
We have been entrusted with a lot, and we want to be generous with that. In fact, Scripture tells us that we need to be generous. But when our generosity gets in the way of others becoming generous, when our stewardship gets in the way of others becoming good stewards, therein lies the problem.
Christians have a natural commitment to fighting poverty. That comes from the foundation of Christian beliefs. But that motivation must be allied with being smart. The world is complicated. And so the actions we take, we must be confident that they're going to help and not make things worse.
It was beautiful in the way in which you tied this all together. What are some of those unintended consequences from our giving and from, you know, the current humanitarian work that's being done in, quote unquote, the third world, as you said?
So I think there's a couple things going on. I mean, one of the big things, I mean, there's, you know, everybody talks about corruption, and that's worth talking about. But I think one of the big things, you know, one Senegalese entrepreneur, Malik Fall, said, he said, you know, aid delays the development of business, right? He said it's kept Africa behind. And so you can see this with foreign aid, you can see it with charity, you can see it with non-governmental organizations. And we tell a couple of these stories, and I'll talk about both projects, Poverty Cure and what's the film called Poverty Inc. And so, like, here's an example. Let me give you an example with non-governmental organizations and charity. There's a Haitian solar panel company called Enersa, and they were building solar panels. And the two founders had actually studied solar panel technology up in Canada, came back to Haiti, and they said, look, you know, we can, this is really important. We have electricity is always going out, but we have the sun. Let's create solar panel lights. And then they got some, there's a company actually in Michigan that helped them with their manufacturing to figure out how they could do this. And so they started building solar panel like lights for some of these poor neighborhoods. And it was really tough to get the business started, right? And there were some of their employees lived in these, some of these two neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince called Cité Castro and Cité Soleil that were very dangerous and poor. And there was a temptation, like, you know, one of the founders says, everybody's like, they're going to give you $500 and a gun, join the gang. And they didn't want to join the gang, a lot of these workers. They wanted this job. So they're like, hold on, we're going to build this company. So finally, they, and I'm putting this in to see the picture, right? So they're working on building a company, and they're hiring men who are fathers from very poor and often dangerous places. And so they, before the earthquake in Haiti, they were selling about 50 streetlights a month. Okay, so they're growing their business. The earthquake came and electricity's out, and there's a major demand for
solar
streetlights. And so they went from selling 50 streetlights a month to 5 streetlights in 6 months. So why is that? Because everybody was giving away free things. Okay. So now in one sense, we have to pause like, wait, so is it better? Isn't it better? Don't people need stuff? Who cares about this business? Right. And so we have to begin to ask the question, well, okay, maybe it's an emergency and you need to provide these free things. But it kept going. And you actually had a local company with local employees who were also struggling, who were put out of business by free things. Okay. Now, luckily, they were able to kind of get through it. But that's just one little example. Peter Greer of Hope International, some of your listeners maybe know Hope's work. Peter's a great guy. Peter tells a story that we talk about in Poverty Cure and Poverty Inc. about a church that decided to give eggs to Rwandan community right after the genocide. And they brought eggs and they gave them there for a while. And then they left and they went to another community. What they didn't realize is there was a man who'd started an egg business that by the giving free eggs, they put him out of business. Now, okay, what happens when they left? There's no egg business in the community. And this is why part of what we were trying to do, and this goes back to this question of humanitarianism, which is a theological, philosophical thing, which is really important. It's not just economics, it's thinking long-term about human flourishing. And what people need is an emergency, you need stuff right away, okay? That's, but as one person said, you know, the emergency goes on for 4 or 5 years. as John Ronell of the NERSA solar panel company says, okay, you're supposed to come in, give a man a fish, and then teach a man a fish. But if you're here for 40 years, there's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. And that's actually kind of the model. We've used an emergency model or situation as the model for development. So that, yes, in emergencies is one thing, but we've actually used that kind of like, oh my goodness, it's an emergency, when we're actually trying to deal with chronic problems of exclusion, chronic problems of the lack of a commercial society, and so on. So part of what happens is when we give charity or foreign aid, we disempower local producers and we harm the commercial society and long-term independence. And so we create dependency. And the last example from foreign aid that I think is in agriculture, you know, we overproduce in the United States and Europe, we subsidize our agriculture, and then we ship the extra either as foreign aid or we dump it. Those are two different things, but, and we disempower our local farmers. And so again, we create these kind of long-term dependencies. So that's, and I go back to that emergency, right? Because a lot of people will say, well, what about an emergency? And the answer is, yeah, when there's an emergency, there's an emergency. But emergencies aren't 5 years. Emergencies are a short period of time. And even in that, we should be thinking, okay, how can we empower local companies to have independence for long-term sustainable development? And so that's kind of a broken model. And I'll let you ask another question, but there's actually a philosophical and theological thing that I think we should talk about. And that's the problem of humanitarianism.
I have never heard of a country that developed on aid. If you know of one, just let me know. I know about countries that developed on trade and innovation and business. I don't know of any country that got so much aid and they suddenly became a first world country. I've never heard of such a country. So the track is wrong. That track ends to nowhere.
There are situations where I've set up a business deal. I'm about to do a trade. I want to sell something to a community. I've made an investment. And NGOs will hear about it because it becomes topical. And they find a way to bring aid money and provide it for free. So what happens to my investment? I have to lay off my staff.
To a large extent, our governments have been held captive by the donor agencies, the international donor community, who are not, in my view, particularly interested in seeing the growth of local business. When we talk to the government says, hey, we're not allowed to buy with donor money local products. That's just the way it is. It's their money, they decide who gets it. And this has been a big dilemma for us. Politicians, they are more interested in a smile on the World Bank country director's face than the success of my business.
For example, five of us companies in Ghana got together, local companies, to bid for a contract, a government contract. Now, everything was going very well. We were competent to do the work. Guess what happens? We're bidding against some European companies. One of the companies got their government to loan our government money, very soft loan, for the project. Our folks in the government said, hey, you know, we love you very much. There's nothing beats free money. We lost our money. You know what we ended up doing? We ended up working as subcontractors to the Europeans. They gave us the worst part of the business, the most difficult and least profitable part. We wound up doing it because we were better at doing the work. So they got the best of both worlds. Their government paid. We ended up doing the work. They took the money. That's not development. That's not assistance. That's thuggery.
So what is the problem of humanitarianism?
So I would say that the problem of humanitarianism is that it sounds like a great thing. Like, who's against humanitarianism? But if you look at the development over time of what it is, and this is a shorter version, but it's basically a secular version of Christian love. So charity we think of as like, you know, soup kitchens or giving money, or but charity comes from the Latin word caritas, meaning love, right? Which is related to the biblical concept of agape, which is a self-donating love. So the definition of love in traditional, right, a Christian definition of love is to seek the good of the other. It's to will the other person's good, right? So there's a desire for the other person's benevolence. And so we're thinking in a very holistic, broad term of what your good is. Humanitarianism is a hollowed out view of Christian love that focuses on providing physical comfort. Now, in the short run, this could be okay, right? Because like, there is a problem. Like, we don't need Bibles, we need food.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we also know from the scriptures that that problem was already solved in the Epistle of James, when he says, you know, don't just tell people go and be well if they're hungry, right? That's already part of the tradition. But humanitarianism focuses on the physical comfort. And so it doesn't take into account long-term flourishing, the psychological, the spiritual, the sociological aspects. It's actually a physical kind of material comfort.
Yeah.
And so this underlying view of humanitarianism dominates the way we think. It also dominates the emergency model. So part of what we're doing is saying, pause, we have to think about charity as in seeking the good of the other. And oftentimes when you're helping somebody, you feel good because you're helping somebody. But the goal is not for us to feel good about ourselves. The goal is to help people flourish in long-term sustainability. And so because we have this emergency model, a reductionist humanitarianism that's focused on our physical comfort, because we don't think about long-term commercial society, independence, and their own attitude. How would we want to be helped? We don't want to be helped. If we're in an emergency, we want somebody to bring us food. But we, in the long term, if I said to you, okay, Steve, you know, I know you're going through tough times right now. You don't have a job. I'll take your children. Mm-hmm. Like, no, I don't want to take you to take my children. I just need a job. But if you think about it, we actually create orphanages that create incentives for people to give their children away instead of employing people. And so there's this broken sense of humanitarianism that underlies a lot of our deeper policy errors. And that's also what we wanted to bring out.
There is a lot of passion for many subjects that are attractive in the short term. And there is very little passion in terms of opening up the economy, in terms of strengthening further institution, fiscal responsibility. Why? Because some of them are so hard to do that people don't want to invest their political capital on them, and they want short-term wins. And if they can keep happy, those that make a louder noise, that's good enough for them.
Some people, in the name of preserving human life and causing society to flourish, think that we need to limit others. We need to limit the amount of life in the world, and we need to take away the mystery. Christians have to be absolutely committed to life. And what that means is that they can't fall prey to the secular arguments about scarcity. We have to understand that we have been given the creative potential to bring not only new life into the world, but new life out of broken things, broken cultures, broken fields, broken families. And we need to be better stewards of how we teach or equip people to think about that.
It sounds like there's a quote in, I think it's episode one, I don't know if it's you or a guest, but there's a difference between having a heart for the poor, which is easy, and then having a mind for the poor. How do people make that shift? Where does that change really start to happen?
So I think it happens maybe a couple of things. So one of them is also a deeply, like one of the deep underlying, say, philosophical driving force of the Poverty Cure series, which is for Christians, and Poverty Inc., which is for everybody.
Poverty Inc., by the way, is a fantastic film. That's where I first became familiar with you and Acton.
So the driving force for this is that human beings, human persons, are not simply objects. We're not objects of pity, objects of charity, objects of compassion. Human persons are subjects. And I mean by subject, not the subject of the king, but like grammatically, another I, an agent who is a subject with hopes and wants and dreams and fears. And one of the problems with modern poverty care and humanitarianism is that we treat poor people like objects of our pity and our compassion. And so the first part of, in a sense, having a mind for the poor is to say, who is the subject of economic development? Who am I trying to help? Right? I'm trying to help another person who's another I, like me. And when we start to shift away from kind of projects as the source of our issue or poverty, but instead start thinking human persons with hopes and wants and dreams who are brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers, just like me, that's the subject. They are subjects, and that's the subject of charity. Mm-hmm. So that's the first move. And I think that's an intellectual move. that's easier for Christians because it's deeply rooted in Genesis, that each, like when Adam sees Eve, right, he's unsatisfied with all the animals. And then when he sees Eve, he says, at last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. And there's a theologian who says he sees identity, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, and difference, woman. And of course, in that identity, difference is this call to communion. And from that call to communion comes another subject willed for his or her own sake. And that's why it's not actually just sentimental to say a child is a gift. Yeah. It's actually an ontological reality. The child does not belong to the parents. He or she exists for his or her own sake and is willed by God, right? And so it is the fact that humans are subjects is just right there in Genesis. Also in Genesis, we see the problem of objectification. So right after the fall, you know, God talks about how work can become hard and mm-hmm. et cetera. I mean, work comes before the fall, right? That's important because work is good. But mm-hmm. he also says to Eve, you'll desire your husband and he will lord it over you. And there, this theologian Scola says, what happens is that the difference woman comes up front of the identity and in a sense masks the identity.
Ooh.
Adam turns Eve into an object. Well, something, and of course, that's obvious if you think about like, you know, prostitution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or pornography, right? Those are evils where the woman is turned into an object instead of a subject. Now, in Less Gravity, we actually do something in similar with poor people, people of different races. We let the difference, their ethnicity, their poverty, the different country, the different language, come in front of the identity, and we don't see them as another I, like me. Mm-hmm. So that's a mind shift, okay, that has to take place. That's the first part. And then the second thing, I think, is to think about prudence and justice. So prudence is one of the four classical virtues, right?
Yeah.
It's in the Greek tradition, right? But also Christian theologians write about it as well. And there are four, right? There's justice, prudence, temperance, and courage, bravery, or fortitude,
mm-hmm.
right? Those are the four. And what's called the mother of the virtues, kind of surprising, is prudence.
Ooh.
Okay. Now we think about prudence as kind of being careful. You remember when what's his name? Dana Carvey used to do that imitation of George. We're old enough. The young listeners like, who's Dana Carvey? Who's George Bush? But George H. Bush, he's like, not gonna do it. Wouldn't be prudent.
Wouldn't be prudent.
Right? Wouldn't be prudent, not gonna do it. And like, and then Clinton was like, I was never prudent. Anyway, I don't want to talk about that. And so prudence, we think of it as kind of being careful, like, oh, kind of timid and careful,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's actually the mother of the virtues. Why? Because prudence is to see the world as it is and act accordingly.
Ooh.
So you can't be just if you're not prudent.
Ooh.
You can't be temperate if you think it's grape juice and it's actually vodka. Right. You're going to drink too much of it and you're going to be drunk. So you can't be temperate. Right. You can't be charitable. That is to seek the good of the other. Mm-hmm. If you're not prudent, if you don't realize what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
OK. And C.S. Lewis, great C.S. Lewis, talks about, you know, like there's a tyranny of kindness. Oh, I'll just help you. I'll help you. No, you can't. That's not, it's tyrannical if it's not prudent, if you don't see the world as it is. So the medieval theologian St. Thomas Aquinas has this awesome line. And I'm finishing a book on poverty right now. And it's the opening quote.
Mm-hmm.
It says, injustice can come from two ways. From the violent man, the violent act of the man who possesses power. Okay, that's obvious, mm-hmm. right? The bad guy, the tough guy, you know. And from the false prudence of the sage. That is the false, incorrect prudence of the policymaker, for example.
Yeah.
Or the charity worker, the sage who has bad prudence. And so part of what I think comes in the mind is we need to think that human beings are subjects like us that we're trying to help, and that we need prudence to see the world as it is and act accordingly. And if we think, oh, if I'm just going to give these people peanut butter or shoes or blankets, it's going to help them and no negative consequences are going to happen. Well, actually, we have to think about the long-term consequences of our help. And that's the having a mind for the poor. Who is the human person? And then what is the actual situation and what are the possible negative consequences of our behavior? That took me a long time to explain. And it takes even a longer time to get in our minds,
yeah.
because we don't want to think about the negative consequences of our good works. We just want to imagine the happy child with his shirt, but we have to think, okay, what did we do for that child? to the family, to the community? What are the long-term implications of all of the help that we're giving? And that's a mind for the poor.
Having a heart for the poor isn't hard. Can we have a mind for the poor? Can you really relate to the poor on a one-to-one basis? As equals, as partners, as colleagues? Can we allow them to put the locus of responsibility for their own future on themselves and then be willing to be guided by their vision?
We need to be able to move from aid to production, from existing to living.
To create capacities in people, to empower them to be able to stand on their own.
People have lots of energy, lots of capacity.
Business is the normative way in which people rise out of poverty, not state-to-state aid, not the largesse of politicians and bureaucrats. It might not be very romantic to think that it's just humdrum business, but it's true.
If I remember right, I think you guys touched on this in one of the episodes, but one of the foundational things for getting these developing countries turned around is rule of law. I remember a TED talk talking about how foundational and important it is to move the third world from corruption to a high trust institution of law. Like, you know, moving from highly corrupt police, law, judges, politicians, that kind of stuff, to where people actually trust them and there's low corruption.
Yes, super important. That's actually one of the most important things for all nations, rich and poor, is rule of law. In fact, surprising to many people, there's a higher correlation between rule of law and prosperity than democracy.
Really?
Yeah, democracy's great, but not if it's corrupt.
Yeah.
Right? What actually matters more than democracy is rule of law. So let's talk about that in the two things. One of the things we talk about in both projects is there are these things called that we call the institutions of justice. And the institutions of justice are, in a sense, often neglected. Okay, they're almost invisible. And in the United States, we have them. We just kind of take them for granted. But the institutions of justice that we talk about, there's a couple of them, but we talk about clear title to land. So private property and clear title to land. Mm-hmm. Access to justice in the courts, rule of law, just part of that justice, ability to participate in the formal economy, and then ability to exchange your goods without undue burden. Mm-hmm. So if we look at the developing world, okay, and then we look at the United States, why do entrepreneurs emerge in places like Silicon Valley and not in Lima, Peru, right, or Accra, Ghana, right? As much. Is it because somehow we're better than that they are? Like, what is it? Well, it's entrepreneurship is complex, and there's of course education and infrastructure and all those things. But there's a couple of key things. Yeah. One of the things is there's no clear title to land. So in some countries, 60 to 70% of the land has no clear title. You don't know who owns the land you're living on. Let me pause for a second. Sometimes when I give talks, Steve, at my colleges, I'll say, how many people want to be an entrepreneur? And they'll raise their hand. Mm-hmm. And then I'll say, okay, now let's look at the situation in the developing world. So I start, okay, no clear title to land. So we'll go back to that. 60% has no clear title to land. So are you going to plant an orchard or a vineyard that takes 4, 3, 5, 10 years to give you production if you don't know who owns the land you can live on and it can be taken away from you, right? The answer is no.
No.
Are you going to build a building if somebody says, after you built this building, your land can be taken away? No, right? So people aren't stupid, right? They realize this is not a good investment. You wouldn't invest in all your podcast equipment if it could be taken away from you tomorrow. Like, you're not going to invest in it, okay? So that's just one problem, title to land. The second problem is access to justice in the courts, okay? So access to justice in the courts. The Center for Research in India's example I give, did a study where it like takes 20 years to get your court case heard. 20 years.
Wow.
And if you're poor, it's even longer and it's expensive. So imagine you start a business. You and I go into business. You don't know who owns the land you live on. And then I break the contract with you and it takes you 20 years for the court case to hear. Are you going to go into business and sign contracts with me? No. So there's no access to justice. And then the other problem is rule of law. So rule of law could be understood as the opposite of rule of men. right? There's promulgated clear rules that apply to everybody equally. Mm-hmm. So it's not crony capitalism where, oh, the rich and the well-connected get special benefits, right? Or is it kind of a new kind of what would be called woke social justice now, where, oh, we're going to give poor special privileges? Actually, rule of law is everyone is treated with impartiality. Okay, This is actually really important because where do we see this develop? Well, we see it in Leviticus 19:16. We see it in Deuteronomy. We see it in the letter to James, right? No partiality.
Yes.
There must be impartiality and justice. So that's how, right? And then we see this development of rule of law in, like, again, Thomas Aquinas, that law must be promulgated. It must apply to everyone equally, et cetera. So this idea of law applying to everybody really matters. Why is England and America richer? Part of it goes back to the Magna Carta, to common law, to rule of law. Now, are we perfect? Do we have perfect justice? Absolutely not. But we have general rule of law that a lot, most, many, 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 millions and millions and millions of poor people are just excluded from. They don't have it. Okay. And then one more part of law is the ability to start a business. So Hernando de Soto, we talk about this in the series. He's a Peruvian economist. He did a study. He set up two sewing machine shops, simple, outside of Lima, Peru. And he said, okay, he got four student lawyers. And he said, I want you to go around and just like a poor person, you can't take your SUVs and talk to your lawyer friends. Nope. You got to take public transportation, no special things, and register the businesses legally so that they're registered in the formal economy. You're paying taxes. You can get enforcement of contracts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can start a business tomorrow, Steve. Tomorrow. We could set up an LLC and start a business.
Yes.
Okay.
Here in the States.
How long did it take? Here in the States. It took 289 days working full time, or like 6 hours a day for four lawyers. 289 days. That means poor people are locked out of the formal economy. So millions of poor people don't have clear title to their land. They don't have access to justice in the courts. They don't have rule of law. They can't participate in the economy, and they can't exchange their goods reasonably freely without due burden, right? Sometimes you have to sell it to a board that sets the prices. So poor people are locked out. So then I asked those students, how many people want to be an entrepreneur now?
Zero.
Why? Because people aren't stupid. Okay. And so one of the things we have to ask in our help is our big time charity and foreign aid actually helping to create those institutions of justice? Or are we perhaps delaying them? Or worse, are we creating incentives for governments not to build those things? Because you don't need a tax base if you're getting foreign aid.
Yeah.
But if you're not getting foreign aid, now you need a tax base. If you need a tax base, you need a commercial society. If you need a commercial society, you need people to be moving and operate. If you need that, you need private property and rule of law so people can operate. See, so poor people are locked out. And then charity oftentimes exacerbates that instead of helping build it.
One of the great sad stories is something that looked like the start of a real honest industrial revolution started in China about the 10th century. They had some small iron smelters, and people who owned them kept reinvesting in increased production, and they got bigger and bigger. And they suddenly started making all kinds of agricultural utensils out of iron and steel. And these blast furnaces going day and night. And of course, it's all coming on boats down the Yangtze and the Yellow and what, all that good stuff. And eventually the Mandarins discover this was going on and that ordinary people were getting rich. They stopped it. They closed it down. The whole thing stopped and went away. Look, a great historian of Asia put it well. He said, private property is not secure. And that's the first and last and total answer to why there was no development in the East. If they can come and take my steel mill away from me and close it down, well, my relatives have learned no point starting again. Let's get a government job.
Go and look at the tallest tree in the forest and pick the best seed of that tallest tree and plant it in a flower pot. you get about a meter high or less than a meter high plant, exact replica of the tall tree that you saw in the forest. I said, what's wrong with this little one? Is it the seed? No, we picked the best seed possible, planted it on that. So what's wrong? The wrong thing is the flower pot, because you didn't allow the base on which it could grow. If you had planted in the real soil, it would be as tall as the tree that you saw in the forest. I said, poor people are bonsai people. Society doesn't provide them the base.
How do we get countries on board with this? And are there any countries that are starting to make this move?
Well, we've seen it changing on and off. It's, you know, kind of not a perfect thing. I think there's more awareness now than there was, say, 15 years ago about the institutions of justice and how important they are. I mean, again, Peter Bauer wrote them. Thomas Aquinas wrote about them. There's an important, very quite influential book by Acemoglu Robinson. I think it was like 2012 or 2013, called Why Nations Fail. And they make this distinction between extractive institutions and inclusive institutions. Angus Deaton, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics, in his book, The Great Escape, he actually refers to the work of Peter Bauer in his last chapter. People like Mike Fairbanks, who's in the film, Andreas Widmer, who's in the film. And then a lot of people who are also in the film, like people like entrepreneurs like Herman Chinnery Hesse from Ghana, Magat Wade, Andrew Mwenda, who's a Kenyan economist, Dambisa Moyo, who wrote a book called Dead Aid. They're both critiquing aid. They're all critiquing, but they're also talking about the need for access. I think there's a new awareness of that. You see some countries are working to build rule of law and freedom of association. So this is, I think there are developments, but still I think the dominant model of how we think about charity is we need to help people instead of what are the conditions that people need in order to create prosperity in their own families and their own communities. And that's, I think, where the real shift needs to go. And that's really the driving force of what we've been, our team tried to do in Poverty Cure and Poverty Inc. And a lot of it's just, as I said, giving voice to people, entrepreneurs in the developing world who can explain this a lot better than we can.
We don't need another UN plan, Millennium Development Goals, or another celebrity campaign like the One Campaign. What we need is a change in mindsets so that people can recognize the dignity and creative capacity of their brothers and sisters in the developing nations and support their own initiatives.
Research suggests that for every dollar put into an SME through a loan or through an investment, we create $12 in the local economy. That equation, even if it's half of that, is so good that we should really focus on how do you get these small and medium-sized companies to grow.
We talked about private property earlier, since it's one of those pieces of rule of law and being able to develop these countries.
Justice.
I'm going to quote you here. In talking about private property, you say it's hard, slow, unglamorous work and doesn't lend itself to a trendy celebrity campaign. Ooh.
Right. That's right. It's hard. I mean, it's not easy either. I mean, it wasn't hard to get private property in the United States, in the West, right? I mean, there's a lot of obstacles to go through. So I don't want to make it seem like, oh, let's just get a private property regime, because there's going to be winners and losers in the private property regime. You know, it's difficult because people have been staying on land for a long time. How do they live there? How do you do this? There's not good rule of law. There's corruption. There's oligarchy. People are going to try to rip everybody off. There's actually people doing some interesting work using like GPS and blockchain.
Ooh.
To create property rights. And so it is unglamorous work, but it's really important work, because if you have private property, it transforms not only your economic situation, but we talk about this in the film, it transforms how you see the world, right? And so, yeah, it's a very important thing. The other thing too, that just for Christian listeners, is this is part of our tradition as well. I mean, this is another thing, I say this a lot, like oftentimes Christians will kind of look to the big humanitarian organizations or writers as, how do we think about development? But actually we have a rich tradition in our own, a rich reflection and a whole collection of thought in our own tradition. So private property, you know, is not just some modern enlightenment idea. We see private property affirmed in Genesis 23, when Abraham has to buy a plot of land for his, you know, to bury up for his wife, Sarah. We see it in Exodus 22 in the commandments, the shall not steal. We see it in King David, when after the plague, you know, after he did the census, he wants to offer sacrifice and he Arunah's Jebusite says, "Oh, you can have my cattle." You know, I mean, which if he would, I mean, the plague just stopped at his front yard. So yeah. He's like, "You can have my cattle." But David says, "No, no, I'm not going to offer anything to the Lord unless it's mine." So the sense of property is rich. It's rich in the New Testament. You know, some Christians get confused, and I think it's Acts 4 and 5, you know, where this question of Ananias and Sapphira, is it 4 and 5 or 2 and 4? 2 and 4. Anyway. So, but, you know, Ananias and Sapphira are not, they don't die because of private property. And, you know, Peter says, it was yours to do with what you wanted. Mm-hmm. You're dying because you lied to God. Yeah. And so there's no, like the Jerusalem, and then and other people get confused, like, well, isn't Christianity should not have private property? Well, there are cases of Christian living where people don't have private property. You saw that Jerusalem community. You can also see it in monasteries today, right? Where men and women give up everything. They die to the world and they no longer have private property. They have, you know, they make vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Those are communities today. They're not state owned.
No.
They're still private.
Yeah.
Okay. They're just not owned by individual persons who give up. But private property is deeply part of the Christian tradition. And this is, I think, really important for listeners to keep in mind. You know, we live in a very hyper utilitarian world, you know, technocratic, where we have to, like, the reason we should study this or learn this is because it has value in your future, earning potential, right? That's how it's like we're Americans too. That's just like how we think. But private property doesn't simply matter because it's economically important, which it is, right? And we have lots of data and study on that. And the correlations between countries with private property rights and those without, I mean, if you have them, you're rich. If you don't, you're poor. Okay. But it actually matters because even if it wasn't economically viable, private property creates space for the family to live out its freedom and its responsibility. It creates space for culture and religion to be passed down. It creates space for subsidiarity, the practice of helping your neighbor. You know, if you think about it, where does culture get passed down? It's not in the Sunday sermon. It's from the mother and the father teaching the children, right? And that requires space. And that space requires private property. So it's deeply part of our tradition. And it really matters, not just for economic flourishing, but for human flourishing. And I think this is where Christians have a lot to contribute by going back into our tradition and thinking about these things, not simply in utilitarian economic ways, which is fine. It's just don't only do that, but think broadly in questions of human flourishing. And when we think about human flourishing, then it goes back to charity, the person as a subject, prudence, and how we then make decisions and policies that help people flourish in the long run, not simply get treating them like everything's an emergency, right? And again, I restate, when it's an emergency, act like it's an emergency.
Yeah.
But don't act like it's an emergency when it's a chronic problem.
Human beings are not animals. Animals are the ones who go around and look for food all day and then get tired and sleep and then next day begins in search of food. Human beings are created for a much bigger mission, to take care of the whole planet and take it forward.
What creates wealth? People create wealth. The source of wealth is inside our head. It's our creativity, something we've been endowed with. Now, if human creativity is the source of wealth, then people are the source of wealth. And if you have a vast reservoir of poor people living in these slums we referred to, that is a source of untapped wealth that far exceeds the biggest oil reserves you could possibly find underneath your soil. That is really your source of wealth.
I was fascinated with the story of Ireland and how in the 60s and 70s it was on par, GDP per capita was on par with Malaysia and Argentina.
Oh, yeah.
And then in the 80s, it started to pull past them. And then in the last 20 to 25 years, it's blown them out of the water. What has Ireland done that Argentina and Malaysia haven't done?
Well, I mean, Ireland is just one kind of example. You know, people think about the Asian tigers and then they call it the Celtic tiger. What we wanted to do was just take a little bit of a detour, right? And look in a different way and think about things. And so, again, things are complex. It's not like a simple thing. But if you look at, I think it's Juan Jose de Boob made the case. I think there was, like, if you compare Nicaragua and Ireland, Nicaragua had like the same amount of hospital beds, it's a very similar population numbers. And then Ireland became wealthy. Well, why? If you look, they had private property, rule of law. They had broad, like they had kind of a broad distribution of private property and opportunity and rule of law and building businesses. So they were able to, in a sense, create prosperity there. There's also questions of, you know, joining the EU and corporate tax. We talk about all those things. So that what they did was they implemented the institutions of justice broadly to their population. And when that happens, people create prosperity. And what's very interesting also besides Ireland is to compare Australia and Argentina. They also are very similar, you know, land and immigration and like the history that there's small native populations, et cetera, et cetera. Argentina and Australia were about the same level of economic growth. Argentina implemented rule of law, private property, free exchange, et cetera. And they grew. Argentina, with their Peronist policies, like following Juan Perón, that's Evita's husband. He, for all the people who know Evita, but not Juan Perón, Peronist policies, right? They basically created a socialist environment and people got poor. Argentina is poorer now than it was. It was one of the wealthy kind of lights. And so the point is, you can get richer or you can get poorer depending on what your, you know, system of justice looks like. And that's because when human beings are given the opportunity, they can create value and prosperity. This goes back to my question about Silicon Valley. It's not just like you have all these geniuses in Silicon Valley. Yeah, there are smart people there, okay? But they also have clear title to land, right? Rule of law, enforcement of contract, easy to set up a business. They actually have, in California, there are non-compete rules. So you could go from one company to another and start new companies. Okay. There's infrastructure. There's this, what I talk about sometimes, we ignore the invisible, right? If you think about what's required for a business to show up, it's not just like some entrepreneur who comes up with his idea, right? Like Mariana Mazzucato, who I think has some weaknesses for sure, makes a really good important point about the iPhone. You know, everything that makes the iPhone smart, most of it was invented by military, like, you know, GPS and voice recognition and all these different things. And Steve Jobs took it and kind of put it together and created a product, okay? Mm-hmm. But it's not just that DARPA technologies allowed this, military technology allowed this thing to happen. It actually goes beyond that, which I think is where Mazzucato kind of doesn't go far enough. I also think I'm worried there's an idea like, oh, well, we, you know, we got ourselves to the moon. Let's create this big government programs and, you know, we can cure cancer and we can, you know, build more technologies. Well, we also use big government programs to do a lot of harm, right? I mean, big government programs are being used for eugenics. And I think the war on poverty was very harmful to a lot of poor people. So we have to be careful. I mean, you know, big poverty industry comes up from these things too. But her point that I think is really important is that it's not just the lone entrepreneur who comes up with this. This is actually the product of layers of complexity. Well, where did we get the military technology to do that? Well, we got the military technology from investments in, you know, government. Where do we get the investments? Well, we get it from a tax base. Revenue. Where do we get the tax base? From a commercial society. And why do we have a commercial society? Well, because we have a constitutional republic with clear rule of law and private property. And why do we have that? Because our founders didn't just pop out of nowhere. They actually read deeply. And why do we have the Mayflower Compact in 1620? Because not because John Locke's social contract, which was written in 1690, but because the medieval tradition developed all these things. And why do we have the medieval tradition developing these things? Because they're going back into biblical questions and Roman and Greek experiences and the idea of the dignity of labor and the linearity of time and justice that we talked about from Leviticus. And so we're deeply embedded in justice and technology and language and tradition and culture that allows people to flourish. We're in a sense special because we're privileged that we're embedded in this system. That's not perfect, okay, but it's embedded that allows entrepreneurs to flourish. Millions of poor people are not embedded in that system. And that's why they don't create new businesses, because they don't have the blessings of that system that we often take for granted. And so part of like shifting our mind is also realizing when human persons are given the opportunity to create, they will. Let's do that instead of just giving them free rice.
My father was an immigrant from China, came to Malaysia with nothing and built a business and has sent his children to be educated abroad, and how in one generation through the wealth that's created has enabled his children to be educated and has transformed our own economics. So that's been important. And then growing up in Asia, seeing the Asian tiger economies that 30, 40 years ago had a lower GDP than Uganda or Kenya, transform themselves through enterprise, not through aid, not through philanthropy, but just through investments in the economy. That's been a really important influence on my thinking. And I think, too, the whole thing of the biblical perspective in terms of the understanding of what God is after, of creating environments where humans can flourish and develop and grow to their full potential, having dignity, man created in the image of God.
Michael Matheson Miller, there are so many more questions that I have that I undoubtedly will have you back on a future season.
Thank you.
What are the biggest takeaways that you want people to walk away from not only this interview, but also the 6-part series, Poverty Cure?
Well, I mean, some of them, I guess I've said a little bit, so it's a bit repetitive. But I mean, first, that each human being is a subject willed by God for his or her own sake. We are not objects to be manipulated by social engineers. We are subjects. And, you know, we want, this goes to both the Hebrew Bible and the books of the New Testament. Jesus is teaching, treat other people like you want to be treated. And so, like, it's just a pious idea. It actually means something in our policy. So the first thing is that human beings are subjects, not objects. The second is that we need prudence and real charity, that is to will the good of the other person, and be careful that we don't try to make ourselves the hero or the protagonist, because we're not the protagonist of development or getting someone out of poverty. They are the protagonists. Our goal is to walk alongside them, help people flourish, not to make us the hero, right? And again, this goes back, how would we want to be treated? And then I think really paying attention to the institutions of justice. So I have an essay I wrote called Ignoring the Invisible. And I can send you, you can put it on the link or whatever. And it's a very short essay. It's about what I talked about with this idea that there's so many things that we take for granted that we can't pay attention to all the time, Steve, right? If we tried to pay attention to what was going on right now, we would go crazy,
yeah,
right? Because you can't. But if we can remind ourselves of that and not forget that, a mutual friend, colleague of ours, Simon Cianca, and I, and another colleague, Tom Boat, a couple other colleagues, we did a project called a little 25 minute short film called The Wonder of Coffee for the Acton Institute's Good Society series. What we do is we trace the global supply chain of a single cup of espresso,
yeah,
and what it takes to get a cup of espresso. And it takes thousands of people, complexity, petroleum and plastics and ships and trucks and farmers and CNC machines and robotic arms and all these deep complexity, so that when we walk into a coffee shop, we say, oh, I'll just have an espresso. You know, we think it's simple. It's incredibly complex. And part of that's not just economic complexity, but social complexity, right? And cultural complexity and this idea of the invisible. So I would say those are, I guess, the four things. Number one, human persons are subjects. Number two, humanitarianism is a bad copy of Christian love, of charity. Focus on that. Seek the good of the other. Three, the institutions of justice, private property, and rule of law matter a lot. The question is not, how do I help, really? The question is, what do people need to create prosperity in their own communities? And then number four is prudence and pay attention to the complexities of life, even if it's for just a little bit every day, and be grateful for those things that give us the opportunity to flourish. And let's help other people get them as well.
Around the world, there are a lot of huge hearts that are trying to make a difference, but I don't see as much where those hearts are then being filtered through a mind to say, let's understand the complexity, let's understand that there are no easy answers, and then let's roll up our sleeves, still moved with compassion to do a difference, but being thoughtful about the very best way that we can accomplish that. The entire body is called to this. The entire body of Christ is called to make a difference. And there is something that every single one of us can do, whether it's saving a little bit so we can give more, or whether it's looking for that right way to be an advocate for a new idea. There is a role for everyone. And it's only in that collective, when everyone is saying, there's something that I can do, big change is going to happen.
Michael Matheson Miller, Senior Fellow at the Acton Institute. What is the Acton Institute and how do people follow you?
Sure. So the Acton Institute is a think tank. We're in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We also have offices in Rome and Buenos Aires. We're an educational research institute that we look at the intersection between moral philosophy and theology on one hand and business economics, poverty on the other, and try to think through what creates the foundations of a free and virtuous society. So we have a number of programs. We have an awesome conference every June. And as COVID declines, we'll get back. We have about 1,000 people from 70 countries. Mm-hmm. That's called Acton University. So you can go to acton.org and find it, or Acton University and find it. It's a 4-day conference with about 100 more classes, 50 different lecturers, and 1,000 people, I said, from all over the world. We do that. We have an academic journal called the Journal of Markets and Morality. We have a number of video series. We have podcasts and magazines and a lot of different programs all over the world. So take a look at acton.org. And then that's, of course, where we also produce Poverty Cure, Poverty Inc. And we're starting a new project, a new center on poverty and social capital. And, what does it look like to have flourishing communities as well? So you can look at that. So that's Acton. And then
how do people follow you?
My work. Yeah. So you can follow me at Acton, obviously. And then also my website is my name, michaelmathesonmiller.com. And I have a podcast called The Moral Imagination, where I talk about a lot of things about human anthropology. I have some with neurosurgeons and on the dignity of the human person, food, culture, a number of things. So that's called The Moral Imagination. And you can find that at moralimagination.com or Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever it is you get your podcast, Spotify, et cetera. So that's how you can find me.
Michael Matheson Miller, thanks for being on. We will definitely have you back on because there is so much more to talk about on this subject.
Oh, Steve, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. It's a delight to be with you. And finally, we worked it out. It took a long time, but we got it. So thanks for having me on your show.
A sense of independence, a sense of human dignity,
confidence,
knowledge,
empowerment,
opportunity,
character,
responsibility,
hard work,
vision,
self-esteem,
the new moral purpose,
abundance of life,
economies can grow.
Anything is possible.
And it's high time we stop telling our people they can't do it. Yes, we shall do it in the name of God.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Exploration Films podcast. To check out this film, you can go to our new streaming service, exploreflix.world. Exploration Films has been a pioneer and leader in the faith and family film space. And that's why we're so excited to tell you we finally have launched our own streaming service, exploreflix.world. If you or your family are looking for amazing films, compelling documentaries, unique stories, concerts, and Christian growth resources that all support your Christian worldview, then check out exploreflix.world and get 7 days free. All the films we talk about on this podcast and many, many more are available there. You can find a link at our website, explorationfilms.com, or you can go directly to exploreflix.world. For the entire Exploration Films team, I'm Steve Reiter. Thank you for investing your time with us.
That's a wrap.